inspired different tradition, different belief. We all have common aim, common responsibility, and common practice. So it is very, very important to use that common experience and make common effort to achieve common goal. That is peace, world peace, peace through inner peace, and meaningful life.
The Dalai Lama says that the time is here. The time has come. All religions now have to work for peace through inner peace. And this morning's topic has a gigantic contribution to make to that. And I think we as Christians need to do as much as we can for inner peace to promote the peace of the world. Today's topic is shadow complex inferior function neurosis projection in the light of Jungian psychology and the gospel. The most important part of that is in the light of. If you want to have an in-depth understanding of all of those five things, come to our two-year course on spirituality or on dreams, and we cover those in depth. But I want to get us in touch at least with it so we can then see how the two are joined together and see the work that needs to be done, and also see how we can work with those and how they show up in our dreams. Connie Zweig says that shadow work is soul work. And it is, and you'll see how it is in just a moment if you don't already know. John Sanford says, God loves your shadow more than your ego. Interesting. Robert Johnson says, to own one's own shadow is to enter a holy place. To own one's own shadow is to enter a holy place. Johnson also says, to fail this, that is, owning your own shadow, is to fail one's sainthood, to miss the purpose of life. To fail this, that is, owning your own shadow, is to fail one's sainthood, to miss the purpose of life. And Jesus said, take the log out of your own eye, and you will see clearly how to take the log out of your brother's our sister's eye. We'll repeat to you that I've told to some of you, I know, because it was so instructive to me on this passage of Jesus. When I had somebody on the vestry who was highly manipulative, and I got terribly angry at him. But I learned that when I get terribly angry, that's a sign that there's something going in my own shadow that has been hooked. And so I asked myself, how do I manipulate? And my first answer was, I don't manipulate. It's a high quality. I would never manipulate. I have high respect for to never manipulate. About the fifth time I asked the question, I got in touch with some powerful ways, sophisticated ways that I do manipulate. As soon as I said that, the energy level between me and that person went down. I never told that person of this. That person did not quit manipulating. But he certainly toned it down, and I never spoke to him. Important phrase right now. And this is where I think we can help the Dalai Lama's cause and Thomas Merton's cause. To the extent that we are not aware of our own shadow, it automatically is projected onto the world. And those who have a hook along that line will catch it. So this vested person who was somewhat of a manipulator, when I denied my manipulation, he was twice a manipulator. So the shadow is unconscious. We don't know it. Other people may catch on to it, but we don't know it. Two primary ways to catch on to your shadow. One is if you find yourself responding in an exaggerated way to something, that's a sign. I chuckle now when I catch myself in an exaggerated expression of anger or whatever it is. I say, there's something in me. And it almost gets to be like a game. Then I can begin to ask, what's that all about? Where is that in me? And the more I do that, the more peace there'll be in the world. The more families do that. The more churches do that. The more politicians do that. There's more shadow projections on each other's and nations. The sect of the Muslims think the Christians are the devil. Sect of the Christians think the Muslims are the devil. Carl Jung said, the louder you have to speak about the devil, and the biggest and most vivid devil you have, the less you're in touch with your own personal shadow. Carl Jung said that the religious places of the world have the biggest shadow. Jerusalem, Ireland, Bosnia, wherever. So shadow work is very important. Now, the other way you can learn about the shadow, your own shadow, is in your dreams. And a lot of times the shadow will be a person of the same sex. A person of the same sex. So a helpful exercise can be to go through your dreams and circle the persons of the same sex and say, what are they like? And where do I find that in me? And see what pops up. Now, I'm just going to tag, we're not going to talk about it, but I'm just going to tag that there's both positive and negative shadow, light and dark shadow. The light shadow is that part of you that you have not yet become that you could easily become. One way to get in touch with your bright shadow is to just write down, who are your heroes and heroines? There's something in you that can do that also. One of my heroes was Bishop Henry in this diocese. I'm now exercising a lot of things he used to do, but I had to admire him first. Carl Jung was a hero for a while, but now I've begun to incorporate that in myself. Carl Jung says again that we have to see things in projected form before we can identify them inside. And one of the things I love about Carl Jung, he takes all these words and we think all of them are negative. Projection, shadow, inferior function, all of these things we think are negative. And he gives the positive light to them. He says, you have to know it in projected form first. So I have to see a Bishop Henry or I have to see a Carl Jung out there first. Then I can identify it in here. And then I can begin to grow it inside myself. But as well as persons of the same sex, it comes in all kind of ways. I want to read you from John Sanford's book. There's a lady named Marie, where he reports about 6 or 8 dreams of her. And I want to show you the shadow here. Here's the dream. There was no movement. This is in the dream. No movement. And nothing or anyone else was present. The dreamer was alone in the hall of an empty, small apartment. The entire floor, hallway up to the walls of every surface was covered with excrement. The stench was overpowering. It could even be tasted. The dreamer was aware that she was to clean up the entire apartment. She woke before a move was made and was still aware of the odor and was still nauseated. Sanford calls to our attention. He says, look, there's no action in the dream. It is simply a scene, but it has a powerful impact on Marie, who awakens with the nauseating scent so strong it amounts to a kind of hallucination. Clearly, the dream wants to make a deep impression on Maria and to convey the message, there is a great, difficult, and repugnant task that you must undertake. Individuation, becoming whole, is a work. It does not happen by chance or by accident. We have to work at it. The dream describes the great task confronting Maria in very specific symbolism. It is like cleaning up excrement that is all over the walls of the dreamer's living space. The dream might have chosen many ways to show her that a great task was ahead, but it selected this particular symbol for some special reason. The dream always is, what's in there is for a specific reason. So we have to ask why the symbol of excrement was chosen. We think of excrement as waste material of the body, as the lowest of the lows, as something filthy and repelling, something we do not want to get our hands into. From this point of view, it seems that the dream is telling Marie she must put her hands into the lowest, most repelling part of herself and clean it up. Among other things, this means she must be conscious of her shadow personality. But Marie, we will recall, had lived an exemplary life. She has never done anything wrong. She has avoided this and avoided mistakes all her life. She has been careful to live on the correct side of the Christian law. If anyone had led a pure life, it is Marie. And now this dream is telling her that there is a terrible mess that she must clean up. That Marie has led a pure life is, however, a judgment from the conscious point of view. The dream expresses the unconscious, hence compensatory point of view. From the other end of the telescope, that is, from the point of view of the unconscious, her life looks quite different. Looked at from the unconscious, it's a mess, and she must get her hands onto it. The mess comes about because Marie has not become herself and has not lived her own life. She has been so good and so pure that she has hardly lived at all. Unlike the woman in Luke's gospel who washed Jesus' feet with tears and dried them with her hair, she has nothing to be forgiven for. Therefore, she has everything to be forgiven for. She is like the man in Jesus' parable who took his talent and buried it in the ground so it would be safe. Marie has played it safe, so safe that her life has not been lived. And this creates a terrible mess. And the dream is trying to get that message to her. So we see how the messages can come in dreams about our shadow. And there are a multitude of ways to work with our shadow. Now, one of the other things up there is complex. The way you tell a complex, if you say something to somebody pretty normally and they say, "No, I will not do that," you hit a complex button. That's how you know you've hit a complex. Or if you find yourself responding like that, you've hit a complex. You've touched one. But again, complexes are unconscious until we make them conscious. And part of the work for peace in the world, part of the work as Christians, is becoming conscious so we don't put so much stuff onto the world. And so when other people are putting stuff on us, we don't get hooked as much, and we can keep the conversation and the communication going, even though they're knocking us over the head. One of the ways that Jung had, and others in his time, had to discover complexes is something that a part of it now is using our lie detector test, if I'm not mistaken. What he used was the word association test. He would simply call out 100 words to somebody and ask them just to respond as quickly as they could. So let me give you all a couple of the words, and I want to hear you all respond as quickly as you can. We'll give everybody a 20th of the word association test. All right, now I want to hear it loud. Just give me a word. Head. Green. Water. To sing. Death. Long. Ship. To pay. Widow. Friendly. Table. Village. Cook. Angry. Tree. Money. Uh-huh. So that's where the complex is. What Jung found is that the most amazing thing happens, that people could answer, ding, in less than a second on most of them, but every now and then, it would take 6, 8, 10, 20 seconds to do that. So I naively asked my therapist one time, I said, listen, would you give me that test? I've always wanted to do that test. She said, are you sure you want to do that test? I said, well, yeah, I need to know what it's about. So she gave it to me. And where one of my places was on the exact thing that you all just did, was money. And I probably said change or something after a while. And so she said, well, I have to ask you then, do you have a complex around money? And so I said, of course. No, I don't have any complex about money. And after a while of talking, I realized that I would cuss Marianne out all the time for spending money when I was the one that was spending money. Now, when I learned that, it hurt. It hurt. And that I've been doing that all these years. But you see, the truth of the matter is, if I hadn't done that and experienced the hurt, it'd still be going on today. It's sort of like going to the doctor for an annual physical. You know, you don't want to go because you might find something. Well, if they find something, they can get started early on whatever the treatment is. And the same thing is true of things like the shadow and things like the complex. But see, if becoming more conscious, it makes us a more integrated person, it makes us a more aware person, the love of God can flow through us so much easier that way. Now, the inferior function. You know, Jung, among other things, is the one that came up with the psychological types. It's interesting. In 1913 is when he broke with Sigmund Freud. And the surface reason he broke with Sigmund Freud was because Sigmund wanted him to say that all neuroses come from the sexual urge. Jung said, it's a big one, but I can't adhere to that. So they broke off. Jung was the crown prince. He was to take over. But the underneath reason, if you read in there, was that Jung had a father complex. Jung's father was a Swiss minister, very strict, very rigid, very black and white. And every time Jung would ask his dad questions, he was thrown off by stuff. And that's why Jung had that dream of the excrement coming from the throne of God down on the steeple of the church in Basel. And he couldn't tell people that dream for years and years and years because he thought if he told it, he'd go to hell. But what it was saying was that he didn't feel like his father understood what grace was all about. And he began to think that the church in that day was getting so rigid, it didn't understand what grace was all about. And part of what Jung had to say was, and his fear was, that the church was losing the experience of God, the organized church. And if it lost the experience of God, it would go down the drain. And if it went down the drain, Western civilization would go down the drain. So a lot of his work going all those multitude of years into the unconscious, and all the things he did, it was try to get back to the experience of God. Until towards the end of his life, he was interviewed by BBC. And the BBC announcer said, Carl, you have written these 20 volumes now. You've traveled the world. You've gone way into the depths of the unconscious. Tell me, do you believe in God? He said, believe? Believe? He said, that's hard. He said, no, I do not believe. I know. That's the experience. I know. That's the experience. So in 1913 then, when he broke away, he went into his deep time. And then when he came out is when he did all of his stuff. And you notice volumes 1 through 5, or 1 through 4, I forget which it is before he goes in there. And the rest of the volumes after that, you notice all kind of difference in the writing then. It's sort of like Joseph Campbell when he went off into the woods with 300 to 500 books instead of getting another degree. And that's where all of his stuff comes from. One of the first thing he wrote coming out of this is a thick book called Psychological Type. And this is the way he studied. He observed that Sigmund Freud and Adler passed each other in communication like ships in the night. And so he just studied that. What is this all about? What's going on? And that's the way he came up with the types, with extrovert, introvert, with intuitive and sensate, and with thinking and feeling. Now, it's America and the Myers-Briggs folks who've added the J and the P, who've added judging and perceptive. And he said that's why they're passing like ships in the night. And so he's come up with something that multitudes of businesses and people and around the world use, and churches and everybody's. It's one of the greatest ways I know to love one another. Right here in this room, I had 150 members. It was Grace Church in Charleston, and I was doing a weekend for them on the Myers-Briggs. And I was taking them through the Myers-Briggs. And when they did introvert, extrovert, we lined them all up. Who's the most extrovert to the least introvert in the whole parish? The most extrovert was the rector. The most introvert was his wife. I said, would you all come up here and share with this congregation how you handle that? Because you see, opposites is what draws us and makes us whole. That's why we get attracted to people of opposite type. But it's also where the rub is. And if we can understand that that's where the rub is the wholeness. It's good that way. I remember that weekend, I had put the types on the ceilings, the 16 different when you finally come together. And I heard a lady over here say, God, these people are wonderful. I want to be with them for the rest of my life. One wife hollered and said, I talked to her husband. I told you I was like that. It's a wonderful gift that Carl Jung has given us. But here's what I love. Again, just like shadow, he doesn't say that's bad. He doesn't say projection is bad. He doesn't say complex is bad. But you go to regular doctors sometimes, they're trying to put a label on you, and you're bad, so you have to go over here, and the good people are over here. He says one of the greatest gifts in all of the types is if you know your worst function, your inferior function. Says there is gold in the inferior function. So, for example, I'm an intuitive. My sensate is way down there somewhere. So the first newsletter of the Hayden Institute went out, didn't have the address or the telephone number, several other things. I've learned to get an intuitive, you know, to help out with that some. What I have learned is that the conversion experience and the high experiences of God are found in the opposite type. So that's why it was, I'm a big extrovert, so that's why it was that was and still is, where I find God the most is in silence. Hard to get there for an extrovert, but once I get there, that's why those 4 days of silence really did it for me. You know, I think that's one reason why Curcio is so popular with all these ESTJs in the Episcopal Church, or ISTJs, whichever, because don't talk about your faith. We can talk about football or this, but don't talk about your faith experience or whatever. But when they go on a Curcio weekend or whatever it is, and they hear somebody else talk about their experience, if it clicks, it's a conversion experience for them. It will go deep. Because what we're finding out is that the experience and conversion experiences come in the opposite types, in the inferior type. Neuroses. What I want to say about neuroses is this. Neuroses is all manner of emotional and mental disturbances, but neuroses, you can still go to work every day. You have a psychosis, you probably can't go to work every day. So here Carl Jung was working in the hospital for many years, in a psychological hospital in Zurich, Switzerland, and what he found out was that the psychiatrist didn't talk to the patients very much. So he began to talk to them and just listen to them and listen to all their craziness and stuff. And here's what he discovered. He said something very simple. He said, when I can get these patients back onto the story of their life, their neurosis goes away. Powerful. I'll give you an example of that. If there's a family which is almost totally extroverted, and there's one introvert there, but they won't let that introvert be an introvert. He's got to go every time they go. He's got to do everything they do. And so what happens is that he represses his introversion, and because he represses his introversion, he will develop some kind of neurosis. I don't know what it'll be, but he'll do something. And it will show up in the body or whatever, maybe a pain somewhere, whatever it will be, but he'll develop a neurosis. But if somebody later on will work with him and begin to accept his introverted type, and allow him and give him permission to please do that. Please go off by yourself. Please don't feel like you have to stay up with everybody else. Go on to bed. Do whatever you need to do. And when he does that, his neurosis goes away. Fascinating. Really fascinating. And his story. So therefore, when people come to church and even get involved in the stories of Jesus, or the stories of a dream group, or the stories of a prayer group, or the stories of a sharing group, and they're allowed to be who they are, we're asked to imitate Jesus. But that doesn't mean to do everything that Jesus did just the way he did it. It means become the most total you, who you're supposed to be, the way that Jesus became the person he was supposed to be. And to the extent we do not become that, neuroses or some symptoms, and we all got all kinds of symptoms, pop up in the body. And we get out of balance. So our dreams may be just showing us the opposite side of this all through the dream time. Then finally, projection. I think this is just vitally important. We spend considerable time in the Hayden Institute in both programs on projection. Because when I was trained in New York, they didn't spend any time on projection. Not many places I know spend much time on projection. And it's happening all the time, and wrong messages are getting across all the time. So, for example, if somebody walked in here and say, "You look like my sister," I'd be mad at you right away. Because I've got that image of my sister in there, and she looks like her, so she must be like her, and we project that onto that person. Or anything inside that we don't like very much, we project it onto other people. Or that we like a whole lot, we project it onto other people. So this whole ball game of withdrawing the projection, that's a spiritual exercise, to withdraw the projection. Now, eventually it sees it's withdrawing the projection off of my hero or my priest or whoever it is so that I can develop that inside of me. Or it's withdrawing this horrible person out there that where's the horrible part of me, and I'm withdrawing the projection. I deal with it myself. To the extent, again, you don't deal with it, it automatically goes out onto the world. So I hope you can see how all of these things, which shadow, complex, inferior function, neurosis, projection, how all of those are vital in dealing with the gospel. All of them speak of grace. It's like the inferior function. It's the least of these. It's the least of these. The way Jesus looked around till he found the least person. So what I want to do for a few minutes now is just to open up for questions and see where you'd like to go with this. So anybody, yes?
How do you withdraw the projection?
Can you give me a projection?
For instance, if I see a characteristic in someone that I really like.
Yes.
And I want that to be my own, I want to develop that.
All right, one of the ways, that's why I think a lot of spiritual disciplines are so good, just the simple spiritual discipline of journal writing can be so good, reflecting on your life. By journal writing, reflecting on your life, put down who you admire, you know, and that kind of thing. Then in your journal, ask, you know, what are they like? And then begin to ask the question, where do I find that in myself? Now, it may not come up immediately, but it will, because you've asked the question, you're going to be roaming around with that question inside of you. It's going to start coming up. For me, that's the process, is to become aware of what that person is like, and then where do I find that in myself? None of us will ever be projection-free. And that's not the ballgame. Projections are good because it gives us a light bulb in terms of heroes, in terms of some things we can become when we gravitate towards that. So, yes.
Probably because the recipient of the light projection likes it.
You see all these people who are rock stars and people who are presidents or whatever, they're so tired of projections. But they keep coming by the millions towards them. Look what happened when Diana died. There were people who didn't particularly like her who were crying all over the world. There's some kind of stuff we were projecting onto her where it had to do with women whose husband had left them or the goodness she was doing or whatever it was. One important thing I learned, and it took a while in my profession to learn it, and I didn't even hear about it till late in my profession, but it's so helpful. And that is, for example, as a clergy person, you're up there and you're receiving all kind of projections from the congregation because you've got those vestments on. You're trying to be the instrument of God. For us, you're playing that part, that role for us during the service. But what happens is people begin to project onto that. I learned an important thing is as a clergy person, if you receive more joy than is called for, or more anger than is called for, and you respond in kind, you're in trouble. That's why clergy just get all kind of stuff. They get elation. Oh, God, that was fantastic. You know? Or, USOB. I'm going to tell the bishop. Go tell him, you know. But you see, sometimes what people are doing, so we get into complexes, sometimes they're projecting their father, mother or father complex onto you. So at social hours, what I would do, I'd say, well, tell me about your dad. What was he like? So I get a little warning of what's coming, you know. You see, if you're not aware, what happens is people cry and hurt and churches split, rectors leave, all this stuff because we're not aware of what's happening. How many clergy are there here? Because 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay, glad you're here, and of different denominations too. Let's give them a hand. They do a great job. All right, other questions? Yeah, yes.
If it is that a complex arises when you have a strong emotional reaction, what was going on with Jesus when he got angry and threw the money changers out?
Good. Okay. Let me back up just before I hit that. What's that? Yeah, father complex. I love it. Yeah, he had a father complex. I love it. If Jesus was going to be human, he's not supposed to be perfect. But anyway, if you back up to the time after he's baptized and he immediately went into the wilderness and had the dream or the vision of the demonics, the devil coming to him, and if you jump off the tower, he was dealing with his tendency to do things of magic, power, miracle. It'd be so much easier for Jesus to pull off his task by exercising the power he could have done, or by a miracle of magic, he could have pulled it off much quicker. But he knew that those were shadow sides of himself. So he had to go in the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights to deal with that first before taking the rest of his walk on this earth. And I think it's a beautiful example of that. Now, in the temple, it could have easily hit a complex, and it's a righteous complex. It can be some righteous anger as well as regular anger. But even getting your anger out, boy, so many people are holding their anger in that it's just doing all kind of stuff inside there and roaming around. Even to, as we were just doing dream work, just a few people, just to get a little bit of that out, you know, you have to work with it. It's very helpful. Now, Sanford has a book called The Kingdom Within, where he takes the life of Jesus and does a lot of that stuff. But again, Sanford, Jung, nobody is perfect. I love, again, what Carl Jung said, thank God I'm not a Jungian. And whoever our idol is, we need to keep saying that. Okay, any other questions? Yes. Yeah, it's giving the other side to the problem. Because a lot of our shadow, you don't want to act out a lot of your shadow. If you're not prone to kill people, and in your dreams you're killing people, or your shadow needs to kill somebody, you don't want to kill somebody. All you need to do is be aware of the fact that I do have that in me, I could do that. But it's making friends with the shadow. You don't have to act it out. That opposite side, yes?
Can you relate it to superego?
Sure. One of the things, first thing I'll say about shadow and creativity is that there is gold in your shadow. We've heard it here. How many people's vocations and ministry and great stuff they do comes out of tragedies? There's two ways. That way is if you have not allowed yourself to get into the suffering humanity side of yourself, your creativity is going to be all one-sided. It might be gorgeous and beautiful, but it's all one-sided. Other questions? Yes?
My inferior function is thinking. I don't know how to treat that.
Right. Well, for example, my next inferior function would be thinking also, because I have a high feeling function. And what I find myself doing is I get excited a lot of times when I read theology or something like that. I find myself in the second half of life, I mean, it blew my mind, and it would blow Marion's mind, that at a meeting the other day, a table in the middle of the room was just off, and I went and moved it back. In my old life, I never even would know it was off. You know? Now, I'm talking about the sensing. I switched on you, as an intuitive will do. But I think you can start doing things, just be involved in doing some things logically. While we're on that, because I think it's very important, and I don't hear this said much, with thinking and with feeling. And that is that thinkers normally, are they just sort of logically saying how it is. But feelers sometimes pick it up as criticism. Sometimes a lot pick it up as criticism. So I say two things. To a thinker, I would say, keep looking at the other person's face. And if you see some hurt on there, stop and say, whoa, wait a minute. I'm just logically saying what I need to say. I don't mean to be critical. Now, sometimes, of course, anybody will be critical. The other is for feelers to be aware of when they get these hurt feelings and realize that thinkers sometimes, they're just putting it out there logically, regardless of whether people like it or not. Now, I would call this other clergy person up and he'd say, okay, what do we need to do? What's up? Well, as a feeler, I wanted to tell him a joke. Then we'd talk about it, and then we'd tell another joke at the end. And I'd feel real good coming off like he loved me, you know. But boy, when he comes on, what do we got to do? Let's do it. What do we got to do? Yep. Well, that's just his nature. You know? So, like, let me say one final thing. And the purpose today is not to learn everything about all the functions or projection or shadow. But the purpose is to see how Christian those things are and how much they will promote what the Dalai Lama is saying, that now is the time that every religion needs to work for peace. And one of those religions is Christianity. And so one of the ways we work for peace, if we work this way, we're going to be talking to each other instead of killing each other. Amen. All right, we'll meet back at 11:20.